Welcome to the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast. Episode 34 from the Society of Nuclear Medicine India 2009, Dr. Lilly. I've got a treat for you today and in upcoming episodes because I've got some excellent speakers. Some of the best speakers in the world attended the Society of Nuclear Medicine meeting 2009 in India, and I was privileged to be able to have the opportunity to interview a few of them for the Nuclear Medicine podcast. The meeting was very well organised, and I'd like to thank Dr. Ven Kat Ratnam and Dr. Karan Sethi, and here in particular, who really organised a very valuable meeting, and one of the best meetings, if not the best meeting I've ever attended. Certainly the best hospitality I've ever attended, and it was so well done. I really appreciate them for asking me along, and I'm not just saying that, I really do feel that, and it was an excellent meeting, and the standard of presentations was really amazing. And you'll discover that in the upcoming months, because we've got some of the best interviews we've ever had on the Nuclear Medicine podcast, on some of the most interesting topics and some of the most advanced topics that we've covered. So I don't think anybody who knows India well would be surprised by the depth and detail involved in the meeting and the high standard of the work. But those who don't know India, perhaps you might be a little surprised at the amazing standard that's there. I did a small presentation at the meeting, to open the meeting, on optimising SPECT. And for those who are at the meeting, as promised, there's a link at the website, nukecast.com, that's nucecast.com, to my talk. And of course, any others who listen to the podcast who might be interested in preparation for SPECT, that was the topic of my talk. Things you need to do to optimise your SPECT by good preparation, please feel free to have a look at the podcast. There's a link there to the PDF file so that you can look at the talk I gave. Now, before further ado, let's get on to the first speaker. Now, in many ways, this was the last person I interviewed at the meeting, but I think in deference to Dr. Lilly, who is considered by many to be the father of nuclear medicine in India, I'd like to present him first in the podcast because I think because of his great experience, he can give us a bit of depth in terms of the history of nuclear medicine in India and some of the work that's been done there. He's 81, but that doesn't be reflected at all in the detail and interest of his talk. He gave an excellent talk, the keynote talk of the meeting, which really covered some of the most advanced topics and was a spur to action for many people in nuclear medicine. So I'm sure you'll enjoy this. I also got a chance, so I didn't get an interview, but I also got a chance to speak to his son, Dr. Vikram Lilly, and he's doing some excellent work with advanced cardiac imaging and with new detectors and also with new SPECT CT machine. So again, very interesting work. But today we're talking to Dr. Lilly Senior, and it was a very interesting talk as well. So without further ado, let's get on to that. Here I am on the last day of the Society of Nuclear Medicine India meeting 2009, and I'm very privileged and honoured to be talking to Dr. R. Lilly. He's the Director of Nuclear Medicine at Lilawati Hospital in Mumbai. And really, he gave an excellent keynote address called Molecular Imaging Redefining Disease. His talk was very illuminating and very interesting, and I think in nearly every talk for this whole meeting, certainly he was referred to in many ways. It's very obvious that that he's one of the fathers of nuclear medicine in India, and many of the other practitioners in India look at his great experience and his depth of knowledge.
I was very impressed by the keynote talk that you gave, and it touched many topics. And it I think what was impressive was that instead of trying to copy what was talked about in Europe and the USA, I think you urged people in India to concentrate on many aspects that that are important here. And one of the things that I think was good was looking at the excellent results you can get by using old isotopes in new ways, especially with SPECT, and where PET is unavailable. One was brain barrier, and perhaps another one you didn't touch on, but I think links to the same area, was liver scanning, because I think liver disease is a problem in India. So so perhaps if you could tell us a little bit more about where you worked, where you work, and the type of work you do, and a little bit about your very long history, and then perhaps talk a little bit about SPECT with old traces, because I think those old traces seem to be just as effective, in my experience in Australia, every bit as effective as some of the newer traces.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be able to give my comments for this broadcast. I was the only person in this audience who participated in the first meeting of the Society of Nuclear Medicine in 1969. And my paper there was Fe59 and ferrokinetics, something which today's generation of nuclear medicine has not even heard of. So from ferrokinetics with Fe59 to fluorine 18 deoxyglucose and FLT is a long way. It has been a very exciting journey. And my effort is to look for relevance to Indian problems. 70% of Indians are below the poverty line. The remaining 30% are affluent, and their number is more than the entire population of Europe. So you've got a large spectrum of people that affluent people can afford FDG, PET, and all the facilities, and the poor man cannot. So to give an instance, I always say technetium glucoheptanate is a poor man's FDG. And we have shown that brain metastasis can be diagnosed with fluoro FDG PET as well as technetium glucoheptanate. So I call it the poor man's FDG. So we in developing countries must find affordable solutions, and we should validate them by back-to-back studies with FDG, so that I can say that if FDG does the same thing as glucoheptanate, so for my Indian poor patient, glucoheptanate is the way to go. So this is one example of how we should look for solutions, and affordability is a very important issue. Because in theory, every newly diagnosed cancer patient deserves a whole body PET CT for diagnosis, staging, grading. So in principle, those who cannot afford it, it is our challenge to make it affordable to them. And that is something which can be achieved. There is no health insurance in India. And therefore, a large segment of population, to my mind, is not going to benefit by these advances, which are very exciting. So this is a social dimension that I'm worried about. And you asked about liver. Liver and kidney are the only two areas where SPECT CT have not made much impact. I do 10 liver scans every day. And I will give an example. Technetium mebrofenin is a very unique molecule. When you inject it into the body, 100% is taken by the liver. And within 30 minutes, 100% is excreted in intestine. So I am proposing technetium mebrofenin dynamic study as the most important liver function test. Just as you do GFR for the kidneys, we should do mebrofenin dynamic test. Normal extraction fraction, 100%. Normal excretion T-half, 20 minutes. So those of us who are doing hepatology, and we are giving treatment, for instance, hepatitis B and C are very common, and interferon treatment is given, and we can follow up this treatment non-invasively by serial mebrofenin. So I am proposing that mebrofenin liver scanning is the most important cost-effective liver function test. And I'm surprised that Harrison's textbook of medicine, which is read world over, does not mention technetium ibuprofen liver function test. Although my colleague Dr. Krishnamurthy has been saying for the last 30 years. So since you mentioned liver, liver is not so much affected by SPECT CT, and that's why I didn't mention it in my keynote address.
I think that's very important. 2 years ago now, I interviewed Dr. Krishnamurthy about for the podcast about his liver function studies, and he presented at this meeting. And I think liver disease is not confined to India; it's confined throughout. But it is very prevalent in India, and it's very prevalent in China, and so on. I think the Chinese could learn a lot from the work here. But not only liver in terms of excretion, but liver colloid studies. Certainly, my experience with liver colloid SPECT, you could was finding metastases that expensive MRI machines could miss. My experience in Australia was that we were finding brain metastases, which expensive CTs and MRs would miss. I think your reference to glucoheptonate is very important, because in FDG in the brain, you've got a lot of background activity. And when you're doing blood-brain barriers, like glucoheptonate or even DDPA SPECT brain scans, because SPECT improves it dramatically, you can really give excellent quality work. And this has been neglected because people have, I think perhaps they want to use the latest and greatest machine without thinking about what's the most cost-effective thing for patients. SPECT CT is very important. What do you think about, in terms of cost-effectiveness, software fusion, so that one CT scanner can do SPECT CT on many SPECT machines?
That's a very important question. For 30, 40 years, we have been doing gamma camera imaging. Mentally, we have been fusing it. I was looking at a lesion in my gamma camera studies, and in my mind, I'm trying to fuse it with anatomy. For bone scan, it was mandatory. I would not interpret a bone scan without having a look at the X-ray. So even though there was no fusion imaging, we did the fusion in our mind by looking at the X-ray and looking at the bone scan. Now, in this hybrid imaging, this task has become easy. So fusion of anatomy and physiology has always been important, and that's why in bone scanning, bone scan is highly sensitive, but with low specificity. If I see a hotspot, there are 20 causes of hotspot: trauma, infection, degeneration, metastasis, metabolic disease. So the clinical context plus radiological control gives me the proper interpretation. So since 2005, I've been using SPECT CT at Lilavati Hospital, and the major impact was my ability to better interpret the MDP bone scans. Now, fluorine 18 has come, and that is going to be more sensitive, but the affordability is the question. All of us have SPECT, but very few of us have. But the inspiration from fluorine 18 is how much more information is being given. And a new idea is a cocktail. Fluorine 18 glucose and fluorine 18 as fluoride given simultaneously. And it can increase the information yield. So ingenuity has tremendous scope and how to do better. But at the same time, SPECT is available to 10 times more people than PET. That's the point I'm making. If there are 15 PET CT centers in India, there are 100 SPECT CT. In future, any new department which will have a camera, it will be a hybrid camera. I don't visualize future nuclear medicine departments having a standalone gamma camera. It will always be a SPECT CT. Because it makes sense. But as it is, I'm asking for CT correlation in many situations, and that correlation is available with a hybrid camera. So that should be the way to go. Now, people are talking of PET MRI. That is very futuristic. But MRI itself is a very unique capability. It not only gives structure, it gives tissue chemistry, function, and therefore, I always said that MRI is basically nuclear magnetic resonance. Somewhere in the 1980s, they removed the word nuclear. So to my mind, nuclear medicine and nuclear magnetic resonance are phenomena of the same nuclear process, and they're coming together is a historical necessity.
Do you think, you did say that every gamma camera would be a SPECT CT machine, but in terms of cost effectiveness, could that be done with one CT machine and many SPECT machines and using software fusion? I know that's labor intensive, But labour's not something that we have short of in India. Do you think that may be a way to make this technology more expensive, more ubiquitous? Because in India, there's about 250 departments, and really you should have 1,000 times that more for the population. Do you think that may be a way to increase the sensitivity?
It's an interesting question about cost. Let me give you an example. In 1990, SOFA in France was making more sophisticated gamma cameras and SPECT, even better than GE and Siemens. The small entrepreneurs are more enterprising than the big giants. So SOFA in 1990 approached me that at that time, a state-of-the-art SPECT gamma camera was costing 30 lakhs Indian rupees. They said, if you give me an order of 100 gamma cameras, I can bring down the unit cost from 30 lakhs to 15 lakhs. I took him to the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission and I said, there is an Indo-French collaboration. President Mitterrand and the Indian Prime Minister signed a collaboration. Please give me 6 crores of rupees. I will buy 100 SOFA cameras, give it to 100 medical colleges. They'll repay the money and from that money I will buy another. So in 5 years' time, we could have 500 gamma cameras at a cost of 15 lakhs. Unfortunately, he did not have the vision to accept this thing. The point I'm making is, by bulk buying, the cost comes down from 30 lakhs to 15 lakhs. That is the way to go. If India wants 500 more cameras, you can negotiate with the manufacturer of the SPECT CT. Where else in the world are you going to get an order for 500 CT? China today has 700, we have got 200. So we have got a scope to expand. Little imaginative thinking and a little progressiveness and not putting your profit first. So I believe that by bulk purchasing, the cost of a SPECT CT will come down to half the present cost, taking the analogy of SOFA, who actually offered me this. After all, they're also getting a guaranteed market, isn't it? They may take 10 years to sell 500 pieces and they're getting an order today. So this imaginative thinking, I'm afraid, is not being shown. Similarly, the radiopharmaceuticals. Gordon Burr is a friend of mine. In 1990, he made a nice kit for leukocyte labeling. Infection is very common, and leukocyte labeling is very important. He gave me 20 samples for validation. I said, I will give you validation. But as long as your kit costs $200, let me bluntly tell you, there is no Indian market. But if you bring down the cost from $200 to $20, you have a market of 1 crore. But unfortunately, he could not see the point. So a good radiopharmaceutical, namely Leukoscan, has never made its entry to India. And we are very sorry that nobody has the vision to see that by reducing the cost, the market increases. I think, how do I give this message to the commercial concerns?
I think you've just touched on a very important point. India has led the world in generic medicines, in a whole range of generic medicines, making medicines much cheaper. Why not radiopharmaceuticals? Why not indigenously make that? In your talk, you mentioned infection-seeking agents like, for example, technetium cipro, excellent agent that hasn't taken off now. In a country that has huge amounts of infection and has the potential for generic medicine, if you go and develop that product, that's something that you can export to the world. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. And ubiquicidine, another peptide.
Yes.
So I've been telling for the last 5 years, now I'm not a commercial man, I don't know whether it is a patented project, but even if it is patented, I would go to the patent holder and say, you will share the profit. If I make technetium-labeled ubiquicidine available, believe me, 1/5 of the world population needs this infection imaging. So you have your profit. With holding this ubiquicidine patent, you're not doing anything. The IAEA conducted a multicentric trial to show how ubiquicidine is very useful. They say it is too costly, therefore you forget it. What a shame. Now, we should think together. I'm not aware whether ubiquicidine is a patented project. Even if it is patented, I would go to the patent holder and say, look, you share the profit with me. I will make the kits in Mumbai or the Brit. And for every vial sold, you get 5% royalty. So today your income is zero. If you give me the ubiquicidine and my Brit can label it with technetium and it will go to the whole world, you will make an unimaginable profit, which it is not even your thinking. How does this message get converted to those who hold a patent, if at all is a patent? Can you help me to know whether such peptides are patent? If you can make them synthetically, Just guide me about the patent laws on this subject.
Well, I think things like technetium cyprate, presumably, that's not going to have a patent, so there should be no problem with that. Yeah, I don't know about that, but what I do know is that people here are talking about a lot of the diseases that are frequent in the West, and they certainly are. Heart disease is a huge problem in India, diabetes is a huge problem, carcinoma is a huge problem. But in the world, the biggest killers still aren't those. They're malaria, and they're infections, and they're resistant tuberculosis, and they're HIV. Do you think in those infectious areas, India has got something to offer in terms of research and development?
In my talk, I illustrated my study on tuberculosis. We took pulmonary tuberculosis for validation. Sputum is positive, X-ray is positive, so 100% sure. I did baseline gallium and repeat gallium after 3 months of multi-drug treatment at 6 months. To my pleasant surprise, 70% became gallium negative in as little as 3 months of treatment. So how important it is to give multi-drug treatment for tuberculosis with a success rate of 70% within 3 months. The remaining we gave for another 3 months, and at 6 months, all became gallium negative. The point is, in the era of multiple drug resistance tuberculosis, we cannot afford a microbiological test for MDR. So I have suggested that a baseline gallium and a gallium at the end of 6 months, if that gallium still persists, it's a warning that you are dealing with MDR. So it's a very cost-effective test, and you don't need much gallium, 1.5 millicurie. And again, if we manufacture it in India, the cost comes down. I have publicly lamented that there are 10 cyclotrons in India today, all having 99.9% preoccupation with FDG. And it's a great shame that not only they are neglecting the carbon 11, ammonia and oxygen 15, there is no effort to making the long-lived isotopes for SPECT. Gallium, thallium, iodine-123. I have been saying for the last 10 years, so I'm very sorry that 10 cyclotrons in the country, 5 alone in the city of Delhi, none of them giving me what I want as an urgent need, is a great pity. So,
yes, it's not only a great pity for India, it's also a great pity for the rest of the world, because resistant infections are being spread to America, to Europe, and no one's really sure how to manage them. Now, India comes up with the right ways of managing it and then exports that information, that knowledge, to the rest of the world.
Dr. Abbas Alavi gave a talk here in Udaipur conference, and he said FDG PET is a very good way of measuring infection. I agree, but you are getting reimbursement in America for the FDG PET, and therefore you can afford a 15,000 test. Here I don't get reimbursement. So you should say that for the Indian situation, FDG PET for diagnosing tuberculosis is not the way to go. You go by the gallium way. Gallium SPECT is 1/5 the cost of FDG PET, and it gives you the same answer. So I said, for Indian solutions, you have to curb your enthusiasm of FDG PET, because our situations are different. Even Sestamibi. Sestamibi also goes to malignancy. Sestamibi goes to tuberculosis and sarcoid. So I told Abbas Alavi that in future, whenever you are doing FDG PET for infection, please do a back-to-back study with Sestamibi. And you tell me that if there is 100% concordance, then my message to India is FDG PET is not the agent for infection. It is Sestamibi or gallium. So we should not borrow from Americans the ideas. Americans do what is reimbursed. They do not do what is not reimbursed. So that is not the pattern that we should follow.
Yes, and of course, Sestamibi is now a generic. So there's a perfectly good example of what we're referring to earlier. What about other areas that we should be researching into? For example, malaria, for example, HIV. I know that they've looked at HIV therapy using radioisotopes. Do you think these are the types of areas that India might be able to contribute?
You'll be interested to know that the first AIDS patient in India was diagnosed by me in June 1986, and that made all international headlines. It was an imported case. An Indian businessman to New York for a bypass operation. He was given blood transfusions there. 2 years later, he started losing weight, and for 2 years, it was undiagnosed. Then when I asked the question, could that blood transfusion be contaminated, because in 1982, there was no blood testing. So we proved that this is transfusion-related AIDS. Then we did 30 patients of AIDS patients. no mental symptoms, and we did their HMPO, SPECT, myocardial peripheral imaging. The message was, even if clinically you have no evidence of dementia, right from the word go, the virus goes to the brain, and we found perfusion abnormalities in the brain, which are reversible by retroviral treatment. So we have a handle for early diagnosis of HIV infection to the brain in an asymptomatic state and reversal with antiretroviral drugs. Unfortunately, the cost comes. Antiretroviral drug is so expensive, but we have shown that we can document CNS involvement and its reversibility. So it's a tremendous tool in the context of HIV.
Malaria, do you think there's a role for looking at malaria with nuclear meds?
The malaria parasite was discovered in Hyderabad, my birthplace, and it was the prediction of this man who discovered the malaria parasite that if you can eradicate the mosquito, you will eradicate malaria. In the city of Bombay, I could control malaria in 1 year by vector control, but we stupid people do not do the right thing. And we are now talking about malaria, vaccine, newer drugs. So malaria is one disease which Europe eliminated after the advent of DDT. So we are forgetting that vector control, which is the easy approach, that we are neglecting, and we are looking for malaria vaccine and other drugs. Very soon the drugs will become artemether. If you are using it alone, malaria becomes resistant, so you have to use it together. So the priority should be for vector control, a lesson learned in 1939. Europe eliminated malaria through DDT. Now we need other insecticides. So it's a stupid way not to do the right thing. And talking of expenditure into gene therapy and vaccine, malaria is an example where human stupidity has created a problem. In 1968, India had the lowest incidence of malaria. But our stupid government stopped the budget of vector control, and therefore the emphasis shifted from vector control things. Still today, let me know, for malaria, we don't need any more research, we don't need vaccines, we need simple, elementary thing of vector control.
Yes, well, people, King Henry of England died of malaria, so vector control seems to have worked in England and Europe. You know, it was a big disease. It killed many people. Cromwell is believed to have died of malaria. So there we are. I mean, you know, sometimes the high technology approach isn't the right approach. The appropriate technology approach is the right approach. Although perhaps I could get onto some things that, you know, some interesting things that I thought you saw that I saw in the meeting. One was an interesting study where you looked at meditation, something that India is famous for, and also other brain studies. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Now, meditation is practiced in India for 5,000 years, and my son Vikram got the opportunity of studying the effects of meditation, and it was very interesting that first he had to show to the Brahma Kumaris that FDG PET study is safe. So he got himself injected with FDG, did his own brain scan and showed them that this is how my brain looks. It is very safe to give you the radioisotope. So he could get 6 volunteers, and they had their study before meditation and after meditation. And what was most striking is meditation has a global response to the brain. It causes global hypometabolism. In layman's term, it gives rest to the brain. An active brain is very agitated. So giving a rest to the brain was a very good idea. And what it showed was phenomena which have been practiced now can be validated using modern scientific techniques. So there's a lot of new grounds. Anxiety, schizophrenia, depression. Depression is such a common thing that 40% of the people in the world at some time or the other are going to suffer from depression. Till now, depression was a descriptive term. Now we have got an objective documentation that in all kinds of depression, there is a frontal lobe hypoperfusion and frontal lobe hypometabolism. So by a simple blood test, which costs 1,500 rupees, we can document depression and see the response to treatment. Extreme example of depression is suicidal tendency. So by giving electroconversion therapy, we have shown that the hypometabolism and hyperperfusion is restored to normal. So psychiatry till now was descriptive. Now nuclear medicine provides an objective parameter which makes very important thing. To know how important this is, I will give an anecdote. Six psychiatrists made a prank. They went to six hospitals in America with a complaint, I hear voices. They were promptly admitted to the hospital. Auditory hallucination. I hear voices is auditory schizophrenia. It took 15 days for each one of them to get discharged that they are normal. And they were discharged schizophrenia in remission. That means the people could not decide on only questionnaire. So now we have got objective parameter. By dopamine receptor imaging, we can demonstrate schizophrenia and show the response to treatment. So how psychiatry, apart from a descriptive subject, has become a parameter. This is a message we should spread to our psychiatric colleagues. And there's a lot of literature which can help us to manage these patients. There's a chronic fatigue syndrome. For years, people suffer, and the doctor thinks they are hysterical or malingering. They are not malingering. And their brain perfusion shows hypoperfusion. So chronic fatigue syndrome is a very interesting example where the patient is happy to know the doctor, you don't believe me in my complaints. Here is the objective proof that I have got a hypoperfusive brain. Now, what I am doing is about Alzheimer's disease. Today, there is no satisfactory treatment for Alzheimer's disease, and yet $15 billion are spent for medication, which is ineffective. So the idea came to me that in the ancient Ayurvedic system of medicine, 10 drugs are described as medhya rasayan, or memory-enhancing drugs. I thought this is an excellent opportunity to validate the claim. Is it a claim or is it proof? So luckily, a mouse model of Alzheimer's has become available. At birth, these animals are plumb normal. In 3 to 4 months' time, they develop in their brain all the changes that occur in human Alzheimer's disease. Amyloid plaques, neurofibrillary triangles, amyloid. So without sacrificing the animals, by small animal PET and in vivo imaging, I can demonstrate the hypometabolism with glucose. I can show the plaques. Now I have applied for a grant from the Department of Science and Technology that I will purchase those 30 mice, look them for 1 year, do their imaging, and serially, in those first 4 months while they are developing the Alzheimer's, effect of my drugs, whether it can prevent it. And after 4 months when it is established, the effect on treatment. This will be such an exciting study that in 12 months' time, I will get an answer whether this claim of memory-enhancing drugs does anything to prevent Alzheimer's. Look at the opportunity. At the age of 50, you can show early changes by cerebral metabolism, what is called minimal cognitive impairment, which at the age of 70 becomes Alzheimer's. So we have got a 20 years opportunity of prevention. And my feeling is that these Ayurvedic drugs, as medhya rasayans, can work as a preventive measure. And this is a very exciting study made possible by small animal PET. That is how PET has become important for new drug discovery and validation of claims of various things. Otherwise, it's a question of faith. Brahmi is taken by people, but there's no evidence whether it really helps.
Yes, I think that's very important. In India, there's a large numbers of non-conventional medicine, but we don't know whether it works. Particularly, I saw papers, posters here on various herbs, bark medications and so on that looked at radioprotection properties. But the only real way to know whether it works is to apply proper scientific method to that, and nuclear medicine provides the ability to do that. Alzheimer's is a very important thing, and it affects many elderly people, but not all. I'd just like to mention that Dr. Lilly is 81 and very sharp indeed. So perhaps we could talk a little bit more about some of the exports of knowledge that's come from India, in particular the doctors who've come from India. One of the studies that you put up yesterday was using stress FDG as a hotspot imaging agent for ischemia. Now, we interviewed Dr. Jane from Philadelphia on the podcast, who was doing a combination of hot and cold spot FDG. I was wondering perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, but also talk about the huge contribution that India has made to the nuclear medicine worldwide through its excellent training.
Now, we are fortunate that people like Henry Wagner, I like to call myself as a student of Henry Wagner. He is one person who had the vision for the last 20, 30 years. And as you know, he is giving the highlights for the last 30 years of the Society of Nuclear Medicine meetings. So Wagner thinks that India has the potential. Now, my own feeling is we Indians have been acting like sponges. Any knowledge which is created, we very quickly absorb a sponge. But not having the opportunities of creating new knowledge, we are not in the search mode. The best opportunity in America is you are in the search mode. When Indian scientists have access to methodology of earning new knowledge, we'll be very good. We are acquiring knowledge like sponges, but we lack the methodology and the opportunity of creating new knowledge. So the Indian intelligence and American opportunities have made the best of combination, and that's why many Indians abroad have done very well, because they had the opportunities. I must compliment Australia also. I had my early training also in Australia, and Dr. Murray and others, they are not... But I have found Australia as a very good combination of the British clinical medicine and American investigative medicine. So Australia is a good mix of both the approaches. America is being blamed for being too much instrumental oriented and too much, but clinical approach, the British legacy, I found in Australia. So I must pay compliment. And we have learned it. My first ytterbium DTPA, which I used for cystinography, was given to me free by the Australian Atomic Energy Commission. And we diagnosed 30 cases of normal pressure hydrocephalus, and they had dramatic response with shunting. Today's generation does not know about ytterbium DTPA and cystinography, because MRI might have taken over. But Australian ytterbium DTPA helped me to treat 30 patients of normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is the most treatable form of dementia.
Yes, Australia actually produced high purity DTPA for that exact purpose, and I've done many studies of that type myself. And, I think the other thing, Australia and India, just across the Indian Ocean, there's a lot of potential there. I think a lot of potential, particularly Australia's developed and has got a new reactor, which hopefully will be supplying the much shorter needed molybdenum. India's also got a high degree of reactors and Brits. What potential do you think India's got to supply the rest of the world and to develop indigenous radiopharmaceuticals?
When I got this letter from the supplier of molybdenum that a Canadian reactor is shut down and the whole of 2010 we are going to have a shortage of fission molybdenum, I wrote a letter to the chairman of Atomic Energy Commission, Dr. Kakodkar, who is very close to me, and I said, please use this opportunity to make India as the center for producing high fission molybdenum. If Israel can do it, if South Africa can do it, if Indonesia can do it, why not India be the center? And what the Canadian laboratory was doing so far, why can't India do it? He has not replied yet. He has handed down the thing to the next one. And on 4th January, I will have the opportunity of interacting with the new Atomic Energy Commission, because at his hands, I am going to get the Homi Bhabha Lifetime Achievement Award of the Indian Nuclear Society. And there I am going to give my wish list that India should take the lead in making high fission molybdenum, and what Canada was doing for the last 30 years. This is an opportunity. The closing down of Canada should be an opportunity for us. And just say, Israel, South Africa, Indonesia can do it. Why not we? I don't know what his response is going to be, but I have forcefully put this plea before him.
I was speaking to Dr. Muda, who's been doing work with arthrosis and injecting joints, and he pointed if India can make atomic bombs, it can certainly make isotopes, and I think he's got a very good point. And I've taken up a lot of your time, so thank you very much for talking to us. I really appreciate it. I think a lot of people could learn from your innovative ideas, and I think India's got a very bright future with people like you.
Thank you very much. Let me end with one point. When I brought on my first book on nuclear medicine in 1984 with a foreword by Henry Wagner, a 500-page book with hardcover and 200 pictures, I was selling for 50 rupees. And Wagner said, in America, you cannot even buy a donut for this price. So I said, this purpose is to reach the Indian. Now my new book in 2009 is costing only 750 rupees, that is $20. So Wagner said, all the nuclear medicine books today are $200, $300, and your book, even if it costs $70, must go to all the world. So it is my hope that this book, which is written for young people in India and developing countries, in Wagner's words, should be universally accepted.
Yes, and I urge my listeners to buy the book, because I also know we've got many listeners in India and China and Africa who listen to the podcast. So please learn from this, and thank you very much again, Dr. Lilly.
And thank you again, Dr. Lilly, for such an interesting interview, covering a wide range of topics that I don't think we could have covered anywhere else but in India. Excellent speech and an excellent interview. For those who are listening to the podcast for the first time, and I know there's a lot from India that may be doing that, if you go to nukecast.com, it'll explain to you how to get the podcast regularly delivered to your own our site. So you can put in your email address and it'll get sent to you. The best way is really is to load iTunes onto your computer and then click on the and go to iTunes and type in Nuclear Medicine under podcast and then subscribe there. But it's important also to look at the old episodes. There's lots of old episodes, and all of them are up to date. All of them are quite relevant. Thankfully, we've had excellent speakers where even the ones that are 4 years old now are still very relevant. In fact, DNA therapy, the very first talk we gave, was covered again at the Indian Society of Nuclear Medicine meeting, covering Olja DNA therapy was a very frequent topic of discussion, and exactly the same topic we covered on our first podcast 4 years ago. So thank you for making 4 years. I'm sure we'll have many more years with the podcast, and please, I welcome any feedback that you can give about the podcast, what you like about it, what you don't like about it. Thank you for any emails that you get, and I've got a thank you from John Arnold from the Environmental Agency in the UK. Anybody, if you're whether you're a scientist, a technologist, not just a physician, please feedback. And of course, if you're running a meeting and you're interested in having the podcast there, if you're having interviews so that your speakers can get better value from your meeting, so that the information gets spread further after the meeting, then please get in touch with me and see what we can do. And if you've got an interesting topic that you might like to have, and we can't get face to face, then we can always do interviews via Skype. So we've got a whole range of very interesting interviews coming up, some of the best ever. Stay tuned next month for the next episode of the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine podcast. Till then, cheerio. Thank you.